Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions either through the chat room or by calling 347-999-1149. And to indicate you have a question, you're simply going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad and you will be placed in a queue. Today we're talking about recent reforms in Kentucky. Kentucky, like many other states, has begun to move away from the incarceration of youth involved in the juvenile justice system to instead increasing the use of community and evidence-based programming. Research has shown that incarcerating low to moderate risk youth is costly, ineffective, and in the long run decreases community safety. In fact, Kentucky was among the states with the highest rates of placing kids with status offenses into secure juvenile detention. For those of you listening who do not know what status offenses are, they are non-criminal behaviors that pertain only to kids like running away or skipping school. This and other problems did not go unnoticed in Kentucky. A bipartisan interbranch task force of diverse juvenile justice stakeholders was convened on the Unified Juvenile Code. The task force met over the course of 2 years to study the issue and to make recommendations. These recommendations became the basis for Senate Bill 200, which went into effect in July 2015. SB 200 created or amended more than 55 statutes with the goal of refocusing critical resources for the most serious youthful offenders, strengthening evidence-based practices in local communities, and improving government performance and oversight. We have three guests joining us in the studio to discuss the impact to date and share their experiences and lessons learned in the development and implementation of SB 200. So I will do a brief introduction of our guests. First is Pamela Lockman, who is a senior associate at the Crime and Justice Institute, we're going to call that CJI, which is part of Community Resources for Justice. Pam serves as CJI's lead in Kentucky for federal initiative Smart on Juvenile Justice. In that role, she is helping Kentucky implement SB 200 and other related legislation. She also assists other states in the development of comprehensive juvenile justice reform legislation and overseeing data analysis and system assessment work through CJI. I don't know why I want to keep saying SJI. That's a different organization. Sorry, Pam. CJI's partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust. Pam previously worked as a senior associate on the Pew Charitable Trust Public Safety Performance Project and as a research associate at the Urban Institute. Rachel Bingham is the executive officer of the Department of Family and Juvenile Services for the Kentucky Administrative Office of the Courts. Her primary role is to enhance and develop court-community partnerships to improve the lives of Kentucky's children and families. In that role, she oversees and supports several programs, including the Citizen Foster Care Review Boards, the Court Designated Worker Program, and the Truancy Diversion Program. We will be talking about some of these later. She also administers programs which provide technical assistance, training, and support services to judges, court personnel, attorneys, social workers, and community partners regarding family law and juvenile justice initiatives. Our third guest is Amanda Baer, who recently joined the Children's Law Center as a managing attorney in Lexington, Kentucky. Previously, she served more than 10 years with the Kentucky Department of Public Advocacy as a staff attorney, juvenile specialist, and the directing attorney for the Marysville and the Nicholasville trial offices. Amanda also worked as an adjunct professor for Morehead University in both the sociology and legal studies departments. She has extensive experience in juvenile adult criminal cases, including complex youthful offender and death penalty cases. In 2008, she received the N. Ray Gault Award at the Public Policy Annual Conference. So welcome. Glad to have all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. So let's start diving into this. Many states have been on the same path for a while, but each is unique. So can you briefly tell our audience what was happening to kids And what was the state of juvenile justice in Kentucky that led to the task force being created? Maybe, Rachel, you can start us off.
Sure, Lauren, I'd be happy to. Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited about a lot of the changes that have happened in Kentucky over the last few years. The task force was actually brought together, as you mentioned, by the legislature to really look at the juvenile code and what was happening with kids across the Commonwealth. You also mentioned that one of the greatest areas of concern and one of the biggest triggers for the initial dialogue was the fact that Kentucky was ranked fourth highest among all the states for youth that were in detention, that were status offenders. They also found, as a great concern that was connected with that, was the Department of Juvenile Justice here in Kentucky was spending at least half of their $102 million budget on out-of-home placements. Detention beds and beds in the youth development centers cost, you know, the department around $100,000 per year per child. So when you're looking at those type of costs, you can definitely see a huge fiscal issue in regards to the use of detention. Also, our Department of Community-Based Services was spending about $6 million in fiscal year 2012 in regards to at-home placements of status offenders that were coming into their system. I think it's really important to know that the task force members came from quite a diverse group. We had legislators, and as you mentioned, bipartisan legislators. Senator Whitney Westerfield and Representative John Tilley kind of led that charge. We also had the commissioner of DJJ, our Department of Juvenile Justice, on the task force, and representing the Kentucky Court of Justice, one of my bosses was our Supreme Court Justice, Mary Noble. So we had great leadership in that role. We also had the commissioner of the Department of Community-Based Services. We had judge executives. We had district judge, mental health providers, the Department of Public Advocacy, private providers, which I think was hugely important to the conversation, prosecutors, and then representation from education. So you definitely saw all pieces of the system represented on just the task force. And I think that definitely brought a huge engagement to the conversation and the dialogue when they were looking at these particular areas of concern. So some of the findings was that it was pretty obvious that significant resources were being used in out-of-home residential placements for very low-level status and public offenders. And some of the other things that were found was just that there was a huge lack of community services and alternatives that contributed to the fact that we were actually placing our kids in the Department of Juvenile Justice and the Department of Community-Based Services instead of keeping kids within the community. So there were some really kind of key questions that came out of their conversations. Were the right resources used with the right youth to produce better outcomes? Does Kentucky use timely quality treatment and supervision to actually hold youth accountable, and how do we know when things are working? I'm actually going to pull Pam in to talk a little bit about what the work with Pew Charitable Trust brought to this conversation in regards to some of the task force findings. Pam?
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, Lauren, for having us today. The task force received assistance in its second year from the Pew Charitable Trust and the Crime and Justice Institute. CJI was a partner of Pew in that effort. Pew's role was really to collect and analyze data from all of the agencies in the juvenile justice system to better understand what the system looked like at the time, how it had changed over time, and what was really driving some of the issues that Kentucky was facing. And it was that data that really informed the task force recommendations. Those recommendations then became the basis of Senate Bill 200. So in December 2013, the task force issued its report. The following months were the legislative session, and the 2014 legislative session is when Senate Bill 200 passed, and it then had a delayed effective date to give the agencies time to begin implementation, and went into effect in July 2015.
Great. And I mean, it sounds like there was tremendous buy-in from the very beginning with all the people that you mentioned on the task force, but I want to hear, Amanda, you're really on the ground with the kids, and
right.
So what were you seeing happening?
Well, and I had been practicing for about 10 years and didn't exclusively do juvenile work, but that was one of my primary focuses. And so it was really exciting when all this started happening because it was, you know, finally people in a position of leadership were seeing what I had been seeing for 10 years on the front lines where, you know, one of my first juvenile cases was a 14-year-old girl who was out late at night and was stopped for public intoxication, had a really bad interaction with the police, really bad home life, and had been living with her grandma, but she was committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice. It was her first offense. She was 14, and we're talking about public intoxication, which if you were an adult, you would never see the inside of a jail. And she ended up going to a youth development center for about 6 months. And, you know, that's just one example, you know, where I was seeing that we were, you know, really going from one extreme to the other, and there was really no middle ground in terms of what are we doing in the community first to help this kid. And so when all this started happening, it was very exciting to hear and to watch, you know, watch it be implemented from the front lines. It was something.
Can you, Amanda, what for those who don't understand, you know, who say, well, what's wrong with, you know, maybe teaching the kid a lesson in that situation, what was the impact of that child, you know, who you might represent? You said you represented for 6 months
right.
Public intoxication.
Well, she was removed from her home, and there's only one facility in Kentucky, one youth development center in Kentucky for girls, and it was in Moorhead, which was at least an hour away from her family, which meant, you know, her grandmother, who had to work and provide for her sister as well, you know, wasn't able to come see her as often. And, you know, she was separated from her school. She was separated from her friends and her grandmother, who was actually, you know, trying very hard to help her out. But so, you know, that separation alone was significant. You know, I keep in contact with her now, and she's in her 20s and is doing well. But, you know, she did end up having she had a lot. She struggled a lot through high school and through middle school.
Let's talk about who this legislation affects. I know the bill, it's called Senate Bill 200, and we're probably all referring to SB 200 just for short, addresses three key questions. Are the right resources used on the right youth to produce better outcomes? Does Kentucky use timely quality treatment and supervision to hold youth accountable? And three, how will we know it's working? So as we move through the rest of the show, we're going to be sort of saying how those things play out. So who, in fact, does this legislation affect?
So this is Rachel. I think it's really important to know what research says works, and that is if we can get kids working with kids and families early, then we can prevent and deter any future contact with the system. And so what Senate Bill 200 really did was to have the legislation make those kind of changes and create that ability to do more work on the front end of the system and to be able to provide an opportunity for more kids to be diverted from court and to really effectively utilize screening tools and needs assessment tools to define what, you know, really needed necessary early interventions could be given to kids. In Kentucky, we have a pre-court process called the Court Designated Worker Program. That's an opportunity for kids to be able to go through diversion instead of even entering into the court door. So prevention has always been successful when utilized in the state, and Senate Bill 200 has really opened up that door. If we get the opportunity to divert kids, this Court Designated Worker Program is 87% successful with the kids that get to come through diversion. And so the legislation was able to put in to place some abilities to be able to have kids be able to really utilize that opportunity and to be able to get some front-end prevention to be able to address any kind of needs, resources, services that they or their family may really need to be successful. And I think that's a huge opportunity for our kids to be able to provide those resources up front and not to have them have to enter any kind of court system in order, you know, to be able to access those. So the bill actually mandated for the Court Designated Worker Program to utilize greater resources and supports around screening and assessment tools, really be able to look at the needs of our kids and be able to connect them with those types of services. So if they need some sort of mental health resource, or they need some sort of mentoring program, or they need some sort of school-based type tutoring program, we're able to identify what those resources may need to be connected to through the screening processes and through our case management and service coordination abilities. It also helped to put in place for not just the court-designated worker program, but throughout the system, a graduated response and a graduated sanction protocol, so that there's more intentional capacity building for our kids. And so, for example, if you've got a child that's in having problems in school and they're considered to be truant, that the school's able to go through a graduated response instead of just jumping straight to filing a complaint. They actually are able to do some in-school prevention things to be able to support that child and keep them in school and have them be actively engaged. If attendance still continues to be a problem and a complaint does have to be filed because the child becomes habitually truant, then the court-designated worker program is that graduated response to that, and they're able to file a complaint through the court-designated worker program, have the direct case management and service coordination happen for that child, be able to do that needs assessment, see what other resources or supports may need to be connected, how we can really help that child. It still requires, through our diversion agreement, for kids to go to school, obviously, and also requires them to do certain terms that are worked on and agreed upon with the child and our court-designated worker. And so I think it's really important that engagement with the child on what do they need to be successful is given an opportunity to happen. For a status offense in Kentucky now, if they are not successful with that court-designated worker in that diversion process, then they have the opportunity to go through a family accountability intervention response team, what we call a FAIR team, that the legislation put in place. That multidisciplinary team has all the community players as members. So you have the school system as members, you have our court-designated worker program, you have the Department of Juvenile Justice, the social service agency, mental health and service providers, you have the county attorney, you have the public defenders, whoever in the community is identified through the legislation as required members, parent representation. And they really are able to case manage through the FAIR team what else can we do for this child for them to be successful? What kind of impact can we make to really be able to connect them to resources? What are we able to identify through a multidisciplinary team approach that maybe individually working one-on-one, we may not have been able to make that connection? I know that in one of our cases, we saw a young lady that was truant having all these issues that I explained. The needs assessment identified actually some anxiety issues and some other barriers. Had we not done that assessment, we would not have known that she actually was having some real concerns about just being in the school and having some real pressures about the expectations of the school and the expectations of her peers. The multidisciplinary team approach was able to connect her to some really positive community-based services, not just treatment, but also some self-esteem building resources that gave her more confidence in the classroom, gave her more confidence in her community, and therefore has been successful. She attends school, she participates, and she's engaged. And that's what we want for our kids, is to have those opportunities. So the bill really helped to build that capacity. It also has done a lot around collaboration and real partnerships with all of our agencies at the state level as well as at the local level. So it has encouraged us to have trainings together. It has required some trauma-informed training for all entities. It's also really pushed us to make sure that we keep our staff current on adolescent brain development and just being able to really look at how we can make sure that our staff are really effectively addressing pro-social behaviors with kids and working, to deter any antisocial behaviors. So I can go on and on.
Well, yeah, I think we've jumped into, what are some of the highlights and components of the bill. So Amanda, does anyone have anything else they want to add to that, what you have seen as the highlights or components of it?
This is Pam. I just wanted to add a couple of things to Rachel's summary.
the task force in its work and in creating the recommendations that led to Senate Bill 200 not only acknowledged that diversion is a more effective response for low-risk youth who have not had a lot of prior contact with the system, they acknowledge that and also acknowledge that out-of-home placement and commitment to the Department of Juvenile Justice is much of the time an ineffective response for those youth. So just as it required more youth to be put through diversion and put more emphasis on the diversion process and made a number of changes to enhance the diversion process, it also limited which youth could be sent to out-of-home placement, and for youth who could be sent to out-of-home placement, how long they could stay there. So for misdemeanor offenses and for low-level felony offenses, unless you have a certain number of prior adjudications, you are not able to be committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice. And for those youth who commit a more serious offense or have a certain number of prior adjudications, they're able to be committed but aren't supervised for as long as they were previously and aren't in out-of-home placement for as long. So there's a number of different changes to the court process and the types of responses that can happen to youth in the court process that is intended to limit the use of out-of-home placement for youth that research shows it's really not effective for.
Do you have I don't know if you have this information offhand, but how long were kids on average in out-of-home placements? And maybe we can talk about a little bit about the cost of that, because I know we're going to turn to, like, what are you seeing now, so what have been the reduction, but just to give our listeners a sense of what, you know, the state of being was.
Well,
sure, I can. Sorry, Amanda,
I didn't mean to jump on your toes.
I can talk to some of the specific data points, and then you can probably give a lot more context of what it's really like on the ground.
Exactly. Go for it.
What the task force found was that for youth who ended up in out-of-home placement, they may stay in either a youth development center, detention, or a non-secure placement like a group home. A single placement may only be 6 or 7 months on average. But many youth had multiple placements while they were in DJJ custody, and that's because they may go home and for some kind of technical violation of supervision, like missing curfew or something like that, they could be revoked back into out-of-home placement. So they would be sent back, gone through another placement, potentially for 6 or 7 months. And so it could actually be that youth were in placement for years for really minor behavior that ended them up in DJJ custody in the first place. The other thing that the task force found is that regardless of whether youth committed a really serious felony offense or a more minor misdemeanor offense, they would stay out of home for the same amount of time. And there was no distinction with regard to the severity of the offense or what a youth's risk level was that determined how long they stayed out of home. And the task force was really struck by that, and that's part of the reason that they decided in looking at the research and showing that longer lengths of stay out of home really do not have any profound impact on recidivism. They don't make it less likely that a youth is going to commit another offense, given that they limited how long youth could be placed out of home, in particular for more minor behavior.
In fact, research around the country has shown it increases recidivism the longer they're out, correct?
For many youth, if they're in out-of-home placement longer, they end up more likely to commit another offense than if they hadn't been in the first place.
Amanda, did you have something?
Yeah. Well, I think for an attorney who was trying to explain the consequences of, let's say, an admission or a guilty plea, we call them admissions in juvenile court, and trying to explain the consequences of that to a kid who already is, you know, at a deficit just by nature of being a child, it was very difficult to explain that there wasn't a set sentence. Like, I can't tell you when you'll be home. If the judge decides to commit you, and I don't know because it's really up to the judge whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, that was very difficult. It was difficult as an attorney, and it was even more difficult for the kid to make any kind of informed decision about how to proceed with their case because it was all very arbitrary and very unpredictable. And, you know, a response I'd sometimes get is, well, they say it's 4 to 6 months, but it just depends on when you finish the program. And that's not easy for the kid to hear. It's not easy for the parents to hear. And so what this legislation did, I think, was made the attorney-client relationship more meaningful, and our ability to, you know, advise and counsel them about consequences, I think from my point of view, that's improved greatly.
Great. We actually have, I have a question for the three of you, and then we have two questions that have come in. Just to clarify, because I know I read that the legislation affects youth who have a status offense, a misdemeanor, or a Class D felony. And for people who are not attorneys or also not from Kentucky, because felonies are different in different states, what is covered in a Class D felony?
This is Pam. I can give some specific examples, and Amanda, you probably have a lot more. I know many of the Class D felony offenses that the task force noted were kind of the most common types of offenses that felony offenses that youth were sent out of home placement for. They were things like felony theft, which is just theft of a certain amount. I believe it's $500. Other types of sort of assault that could actually be something as simple as a school fight or something where there's some injury but not significant bodily injury, things like that, I think, are common sort of Class D felony offenses. But, Amanda, you probably have many more examples.
I think that felony theft is probably the most common. There are, of course, trafficking in controlled substances. It would have to be a fight at a school would probably be misdemeanor, but I think what's important to note is that what Senate Bill 200 did, because I think a lot of people hear Class C felonies and are worried about public safety. One thing that they were explicit to do was to exclude any sex offenses and any offenses that involved a weapon. So even though there are some Class D felonies that are technically sex offenses, if it was a sex offense, then it wasn't included in this legislation. And that was for the reason, I think, what I suspect is why the question is being asked, because if you hear felony, you think they must be pretty serious. But a lot of the offenses really are, you know, it's the same offense, but it's based on value. So like Pam said, a theft that's over $500 is a felony, while a theft that's $499 is just a misdemeanor.
Certain
possession, not just trafficking, but there are certain possession of controlled substances, depending on the substance and the amount. Those are also considered felonies.
Okay, great. Thank you. Cindy had a question that she wanted, I think, a little bit more information about the FAIR Teens, which, again, stands for Family Accountability Intervention and Response. Who is actually a part of those teams?
So this is Rachel. The FAIR teams are really, the legislation did a very nice job of outlining who was considered to be the members on the FAIR team. And what the goal was to be able to have that really multidisciplinary approach that was going to include those people that knew what was happening in the community, knew what the resources are in the community, and knew how to really engage solutions for kids. They are specific members that have been designated. So there's our local court designated worker staff, there's our community-based services social worker in the community that is going to have that knowledge about services that are available through the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, and they're authorized to actually facilitate those services or have access to them. There's the county attorney, the public defender is represented, there's a local school representative, a local law enforcement representative. And then we have in Kentucky what we call regional interagency councils, and they really provide services and supports for kids that have been identified with behavioral needs across the spectrum. And so those representatives have actually statutorily required members. So the chair of that board is a team member as well as a parent representative. There's an additional school representative that comes from that board. The Department of Juvenile Justice has a representative on that board. And so there are specific representation that really is about really service array and access. And I think the big thing for the court-designated worker program is to be able to have access to a group of people that can make the connections to services that my staff may not be able to directly make. So, for example, if there needs to be some in-home resources brought in for the family that have been identified as a need for that child, then we're able to work with that team on how to get there. How can we provide transportation, for example, to a family? We have a young person that really needs to have some treatment. The family can't transport. How do we overcome those barriers to actually get that child to that treatment? And the people at the table, they either know how to access that through possibly Medicaid or through their private insurance, or they know people in the community that can help to build capacity around something like transportation. So I think it's really important on the FAIR team membership that there's this diverse group of people that have some real ownership and relationships in the community that one person on their own doesn't have. There's also some three additional slots on the FAIR team that are really local community people that are either involved in some way in juvenile justice issues or may have some sort of access relationship with other services. So one example is that, you know, pretty much every community knows who the go-to person is to get a family some needed tools. So it could be, it could be just basic service needs like food, clothing, and things like that. So who are the people that are the go-to people in the community? Who are the people that know how to get to services and resources? Hope that kind of gives a good picture of the team membership.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Rachel, does that include the, because it was my understanding that other people who were involved in the system could apply to be a member and they would have to be approved by the FAIR team. Are those the three slots that you're talking about, or?
Yes. So how it operates is that there are those required members that have been established through the legislation as the core team members, and then they
right.
are able to look at who else may be able to fill those three slots. When we first began the implementation, because as you would expect, when you have to roll out a FAIR team in every judicial district in the state of Kentucky. So we're looking at 60 judicial districts in a very short time period. So implementation actually began in July of 2014 for the FAIR teams and for the Court Designated Worker Program. And then the legislation's full implementation was in July 1st of 2015, which included the court piece as well as the Department of Juvenile Justice. So what we did was is we actually were able to pull together those core team members, and then they were able to have applications, as you had mentioned. They were able to have people actually, we had a community meeting, and they were actually able to apply to be those additional members, and then those were taken to the FAIR team, and they decided who would be the best fit to really kind of complete the team.
Okay. I'd like to move on to Jim's question now. He mentioned that there's such a high number of referrals from the schools traditionally, and you all talked about graduated responses, especially in the truancy realm. Could you give some examples of really what those graduated responses could look like and the amount of time that would be given before a referral would be made to court?
So this is Rachel. If it's okay, I'll kind of start it. What we have seen from the schools is that they have multiple different things they do. There are several of our school districts have implemented things like restorative justice practices at the school level. They have done what we have worked with them collaboratively on the truancy diversion program, which is to work with kids to be able to resolve any kind of issues about actually coming to school. At that point, as soon as they've been identified as having some absences or having some things that are really restricting them from school attendance, they also have, this is really kind of engaged everyone in a dialogue at the community level on how we can improve some of those things. So I've really seen a cultivation of tutoring resources, and in school we have family resource centers that are becoming more engaged. There's a lot of conversations about how can we keep kids from ever having a complaint filed and do more work at the school level, and having the school as an active participant, not just on the task force and not just as members of the FAIR teams, but also we've done a lot of training on the overall intent of the legislation and have really seen the schools engaged in helping to build and establish more of a graduated response from their standpoint before it ever even gets to having a complaint filed.
Great. Pam or Amanda, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I think she covered it.
Yep.
Okay. So before we move on to maybe the, even though you really already have been talking about the impact so far, were there any other sort of highlights or components of Senate Bill 200 you want to share with the audience?
Well, I would like to, this is Rachel, I would like to mention something about implementation, because I think that it's really important that when people look at such a system change that is going to impact really all of every jurisdiction within a state, and Kentucky does have 120 counties on top of those 60 judicial districts, you're looking at a real intentional communication plan that should happen, as well as we really kind of tried to stick to the implementation science and use the drivers to define what was considered to be best practices to go into the communities, educate them on what Senate Bill 200 meant to them, and then to be able to really build some training capacity with the FAIR teams before we even started hearing cases. And so I think being intentional when you do those kind of reforms has helped us. And I don't think there's a, you know, we've perfected it, but I think that it definitely made the state more aware of what it meant when the FAIR teams came to their jurisdiction, and it seemed to be a little bit easier to actually implement. So I just wanted to mention that, because I think for this legislation, it really was a huge reform, and it's been very interesting to see how the state has embraced it. So I just want to mention that.
Sure. And I also want to remind our listeners to continue asking questions through the chat room or call 347-994-1149, and you can press the number one on your telephone keypad. So let's move into the benefits so far. I mean, this legislation was projected to save taxpayers $24 million over 5 years. So what do we see going on so far?
Well, this is Amanda. I'll start out. You know, we're nearly 1 year into the full implementation period, and what the data is showing is that the legislative reforms are working, and they're working pretty well. They've had a really positive impact on the number of kids who have been committed to the Department of Juvenile Justice and going to out-of-home placements, which, you know, the estimates of how much that costs is $87,000 per year per bed. I think it's probably too early to get into how much to do any kind of calculation or do any of the math on how much we've saved this year. But just to give you some numbers, overall DJJ, that's the Department of Juvenile Justice, they've experienced a 40% reduction in total out-of-home placements since mid-2014, due in large part to these reforms. And if you take if you just look at the kids who were impacted by Senate Bill 200 and you take out the sex offenders and you take out the weapon offenses, then you look at a 73% reduction in youth development center placements. And these are the ones that are the long-term, the secure residential facilities that we've talked about as being not helpful and, in fact, detrimental to kids. And so this translates to cost savings, but it also means that there's more kids who are in these facilities who have who we can actually focus those resources on, which was the intent of the legislation. And I think something else that I guess that I've heard about more, I've been out of the courtroom for about 6 months now, but in talking to public defenders who I remain close with, you know, their dockets are shrinking. They don't have to spend as much time working on smaller cases that, you know, like the skipping school or running away, that, you know, their status offense dockets have all but disappeared because they're going to FAIR teams, and I'll let Rachel talk about that a little more. Mm-hmm. I had one public defender tell me he was actually kind of sad because he didn't get to spend as much time with some of the kids who he knew he would have they would come into his office, he'd have a conversation with him, he would you know, give them a pep talk, and then they would go through the court system and never see them again because they were, you know, a low-level offender that probably shouldn't have been in the courtroom in the first place. But, you know, I think that highlighted the whole point. Like, he shouldn't be seeing those kinds of kids. Those kids should never make it to court. And you know, I think that's been the real benefit that I've been able to see and sort of on the back end of it. But I think Rachel can talk about kids – how they have
been
making it to court.
So what you're saying is that attorneys are really now, well, hopefully will continue to have the time to concentrate on the cases they need to be concentrating on,
right,
and be more prepared and develop relationships with their clients, too.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it sounds like, Rachel, you have something to say, and I want to make sure Pam also gets to respond.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, we're seeing a impact because we're able to actually have more kids coming into diversion. So statewide, we're seeing right now, we've been looking at quarterly our numbers just to gauge what we look like from January through March of this year compared to last year. And statewide, we're looking at about a 30% increase in diversion. So that right there is huge for us. It doesn't mean we're seeing a huge increase in the number of complaints. So what we're seeing are more kids that would have gone to court now have an opportunity for diversion. So that's important. If we get the chance to work with them, as I had mentioned earlier, our success rate's really high. And so that's really important for that opportunity. We've got about half of our kids that have gone, because we have, as Pam had mentioned earlier, we have had a rollout of the FAIR team. So of those that have heard cases and we can actually work with kids potentially up to 6 months, then we are seeing about half of our kids that have gone through the FAIR team process and completed it, only about 48% of those are going on to have court contact. So we're already making an impact on the number that even get to the court docket. We've got one community that said that they used to have juvenile court twice a week, and now they've had to drop it to one day a week because they just don't have the caseload. That's a big impact.
I've heard that statewide, I've heard that all over the place.
Yeah, that's a big impact, and I think that you guys really touched on the comment about the attorneys working with the appropriate kids as they should. But I also think it's the appropriate kids getting to court, and it's not the kids that don't need to be in the court system. And I think that is a huge success. I know that there has been a lot of doors that are beginning. We're seeing open in communities on just how to access services. Sometimes if you don't ask for them, then you don't get them, and now we're all asking, you know, help us do this, help us do that, help us figure out how to have crisis mobilization, help us figure out how to develop some more, you know, substance abuse programs. And, you know, sometimes if you don't ask for them, then people don't know that it's needed. And the FAIR teams have really started to ask, and you can see that kind of response for service access for kids. So that's exciting. Pam, did I miss anything?
No, I think both of you summarized the impacts that we've seen already very well, and I would just say that part of our job in the state is to help support the state agencies through implementation, and a big part of that is making sure that the agencies are collecting the data that they need to determine if the legislation is having the impact it intended to have. And so I think there's already been a lot of improvement in the data that the agencies have access to and are able to report on, and this is a key role of the Oversight Council, which I think we're going to talk about in a minute, that is sort of tasked with monitoring the implementation of the legislation.
Well, why don't you just tell us about that now? And the data that's being collected.
Create a transition for myself.
Great job on that, Pam. Great job.
The Oversight Council, the Juvenile Justice Oversight Council, was established in Senate Bill 200 as a sort of newly formed body that was to be in place for 8 years. And it has a number of members that were involved in the initial Juvenile Code Task Force. It also has some additional members. It's co-chaired by the Senate Judiciary Chair and the House Judiciary Chair, and has representatives from the Justice and Public Safety Cabinet, the commissioners of the Department of Juvenile Justice, Department of Community-Based Services, Behavioral Health. It has representation from the Department of Education, the Administrative Office of the Courts. There are also a number of other stakeholder representatives, including the public advocate, the representatives from local school systems, local law enforcement agencies, local service providers. There's also a judge and a county attorney representative on the Oversight Council. And so as you can tell, that is a really broad array of stakeholders and stakeholders that represent different perspectives of the juvenile justice system. And much of what they are responsible for is actually tracking whether the reforms have been implemented, how they have been implemented, any implementation challenges, and also what the outcomes are for the juvenile justice system. And they're also tasked with sort of looking at additional issues in juvenile justice that the state may want to take on in the coming years. So it's a really fantastic group, and it's, I think, supported the implementation effort tremendously in Kentucky.
And this is Rachel.
Amanda. Go ahead. Yep.
Go ahead, Amanda.
Well, I was just going to say on that note that, you know, we redid the adult penal code and House Bill 463 and made some really great changes, in my opinion. But I didn't see the same type of collaboration across agencies that I've seen with Senate Bill 200, and I think that's been a the biggest reason it's succeeded. And it's a shift in the collaboration. I think that, Rachel and I talked before about that it used to be a lot more territorial, I guess, with, you know, who was making what decision and, you know, what you could do and what you couldn't do. And now it really seems to me that all of the organizations and all the agencies have just come together to help do what's going to benefit kids. And that's been very refreshing and encouraging, and I just commend them for doing that.
We have about 15 minutes left, so I want to move into really some of the lessons learned so far in both the development and implementation. I know we already heard about the importance of a communication plan, but for other states that are looking at a legislative response and such an enormous one, maybe like this, what are some tips that you would like to share?
So this is Rachel. I think one of the biggest ones for us was we had some really great champions. You know, I had mentioned that our Deputy Chief Justice Mary Noble from the Supreme Court was on the original task force. Senator Westerfield and Representative Tilley were huge, strong people involved with it. And I think that really mobilized all of the other entities that were involved and all the different partners. And I think that's, when you can find those people in leadership that are really all about kids and about trying to make things successful for kids and to really help support that, I think that has been a huge benefit to the state. And the openness, you know, Amanda really hit on it when she made the comment about just, you know, being impressed with how everyone's talking and communicating. And those doors have really been opened. We had started to build that a little bit through the years, but the bill really put in motion some really great opportunities for us to sit down and figure out solutions together and move forward together, always having our eye on what's best for kids. So I think that's very exciting to be able to find those people to be able to make that movement with you.
Pam?
I think both Amanda and Rachel covered all the main points. I would just say that in addition to having strong champions and strong collaboration, I would say that the having the access to data and having the support to really understand what the research says works in juvenile justice and being able to compare what your system looks like to what the research says is effective, that can really ground any kind of state task force or work group in figuring out what types of changes they might want to make in their system and can really make the legislation that they develop data-driven and much more likely to see the types of outcomes that they intend to in the process.
And I think that's carried on. I'm sorry, this is Rachel. I think that's carried on in the expectation on the Oversight Council. They expect to see data. They want to talk about data. They want to be able to look at the outcomes and the performance measures. And I think that's been hugely powerful because everyone has come together under a common language. And when we started this process, the biggest barrier was understanding each other's languages, being in different pieces of the system or different agencies. And so what needs assessment meant in one area didn't necessarily mean the same thing in another. So having that common language has really helped, and the Oversight Council has been a key to keep that, you know, kind of together.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms, if we're talking about what lessons have been learned and what you can expect when you're trying to reform a system, if you're doing it the way that Kentucky's done it, which is evidence-based and paying attention to the research and being very systematic in how you do it, it's a long process. And I think Rachel and Pam can speak to that more than I can, but I appreciate that they have taken time, and I appreciate that things are, you know, it's not like the bill was enacted and the next day everything changed. I think people expect that, but I think it has been more, it's more meaningful and long-lasting if it is a process and it's something that, you know, we're going to spend the next, you know, well, I don't know that it stops. I think we continue to evolve, and I think we're going to continue to learn from what didn't work and what did work, and hopefully that's what the, you know, Oversight Council will stay around, and I think that's been a huge benefit because we can continue to assess and reassess, and I think that's what's going to make our system be as best as it can be.
Well, speaking of a long process, I'm sure it hasn't been easy, and so what have been some of the challenges, and what are your hopes for the next few years as Kentucky continues to reform its juvenile justice response?
So this is Rachel. I think one of our greatest challenges in the court-designated worker is just making sure that we are training staff to be at the level in their case management and service coordination skills that need to happen for kids and to be successful. And I appreciate what Amanda said about the long term, because that's what it takes. It's, you know, we are seeing some results now, but the real results are going to be, you know, where our kids are 3 to 5 years from now. And are we really making that kind of impact to keep kids from ever coming through the door? And if diversion's working the way it's supposed to, then they won't be back. And that's what our goal is, and, you know, that's where we're driving towards. And so we've been, one of our challenges is having time to, you know, to train staff, and they have cases to process and kids to work with, but you have to keep bringing them back and engaging them to be able to talk about, you know, how to really work towards those pro-social behaviors with kids and how to keep building that capacity. And I think that conversation, as Amanda said, it never ends. And it never ends the communities talking to each other. You always are, you know, there's somebody else that comes new into a community in a new role. And so sometimes we think, oh, well, we already did that. We already trained law enforcement, or we already trained, you know, our local teachers. Well, that's an ongoing process. We should always be thinking that that kind of local community development is part of the package. And that's where success comes, that you're continually training and talking and building better relationships. So I think that's a challenge, but it also is one that comes with the territory. You know, we all obviously do this work because we believe in success, and so we are trying to help our families get there. So I think that's a challenge, but also a good one to work towards.
Mm-hmm. My hope is that Kentucky maintains this momentum and that we continue to put individuals in positions of, you know, leadership positions who are thinking and doing the work that they're doing now. And I, you know, more specifically, I'm hopeful that we can start realizing the benefits in terms of developing and enhancing community-based resources. And a lot of our less populated or rural, that's always a hard word for me to say, those areas where I grew up, there's not a lot there, and so your alternative options are very limited. And you know, you can change a law and say you can't commit kids, but if you want it to be successful and you want the kids, like Rachel said, if you want to look at them in 3 to 5 years and make sure that they're successful, you have to start building those community-based resources so that it can realize the full effects. So I hope we can start looking towards that as things continue.
Yep.
And I would just add that, you know, I think, you know, we feel particularly privileged at CJI that the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, through the Smart on Juvenile Justice Initiative, has, you know, provided us with resources and funded us to work with Kentucky to support the implementation of Senate Bill 200. It's something that, you know, I feel particularly grateful for the opportunity to be able to help the agencies and all the stakeholders in the system really work to see the effects of this legislation. And I think that the support is really critical to making sure that implementation goes as well as it can, and that the agencies are supported in addressing the challenges that are to be expected in the process.
I think that's a great point, Pam. This is Rachel. I think one of the, to build upon that, as a state perspective, it's awesome to be a part of the Smart on Juvenile Justice, because we do have that long-term technical assistance and support. And I think that has made a huge difference in keeping us united and together, and has really been able to give us some core pieces that are going to be sustainability pieces that have been able to come from the national perspective. So we appreciate that very much, too.
Well, I want to thank the three of you so much for being guests on the show today. it'll be exciting to hear maybe where you are in a year. Maybe we can check in again on this.
Absolutely.
Sounds great.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you.
For our listeners who maybe want some more information, some resources to check out, the Crime and Justice Institute's website is www.crj.org/CJI. The task force report is at www.lrc.ky.gov. You can research it, search for it there. The Kentucky Courts website, if you want that, is kycourts.net. And education.ky.gov/schools has an FAQ document on this. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at childrenslawky.org. And take care and see you next time on Spotlight on News. And thank you again, Pam, Rachel, and Amanda.
Thank you.